It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest says we are at war with the food industry. He says food has grown less healthy over the last decades as companies try to make food cheaper and more appealing. And at the center of the war, it's sugar.
Dr. Robert Lustig joins us now. He spent the past 20 years treating childhood obesity, and he's the author of the New York Times bestseller called Fat Chance. He's got a new ebook out. It's called Sugar Has 56 Names. And Robert, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me. Appreciate it. And it's nice to be back in Wisconsin, even if it is by radio. I was a faculty member at UW for 5 years.
Well, welcome back. It's good to hear you, even if over the air. You should stop by sometime again.
I do. I actually come back relatively frequently.
Excellent. Well, you can stop by public radio and say hi sometime. Well, I want to get to your ebook. You say that we're at war with the food industry. What do you mean by that?
Well, unfortunately, it's a war we don't know we're fighting. What's good for them is bad for us, and what's good for us is bad for them. There is no middle ground. If that's a war. The problem is what they have decided to do is provide us with the food that costs them the least and makes them the most. And in the process, we are losing our health. And the relation between the change in our diet that occurred back in the late 70s when we went low-fat to our current obesity, diabetes, dementia, and every other aspect of metabolic syndrome debacle is now very clear, not just in terms of correlation, but in terms of causation. And when presented with that information, the food industry does a very, very clear shuffle, stating that this is the job of the consumer to make its own decisions and its own choices, except, of course, they don't tell us what those choices are, and they actually hide that information so that the consumer can't possibly know. I would call that a war.
The big change you mentioned back in the 70s was a rise since then in sugar in our foods. How much has sugar increased in the food we eat over the last three, four decades?
Well, in fact, if you look at the change in sugar consumption worldwide over the past 200 years, first of all, we went from about 5 grams of sugar a day now to 100 grams of sugar per day. And within the specific frame of those 30 years, we've gone from about 50 to 100. So we have doubled our sugar consumption over the past 30 years, but we had already increased our consumption many times over to get us closer to the toxic threshold during the previous century and a half. We basically have been overdosed over the course of time, in part because sugar is affordable now. It's cheap. It's now synthetic. It's basically been added to every food, very specifically because the food industry knows when they do, you buy more.
Right. Well, you write about sugar, and I think you said that, you know, a portion of the population is going to respond to it sort of like a drug, almost like a kind of addiction, and that the rest of us will have a milder form of that. Is that why sugar
That's right.
is showing up in food now? Is it a drug?
In fact, it is a drug. It's like any other white powder. In fact, coca leaves are medicinal, but cocaine, when it's refined, is addictive. Opium poppies were medicinal, but when combined with tobacco and put in, when it was refined in the 17th century, it became addictive. And the same thing with sugarcane. It could be certainly a source of energy. It could be, you know, a flavoring agent. But now that it's refined to a, white powder, we have very similar effects. Bottom line is, a little is okay. And a little is what we used to have, and a lot is not. And that's what we have now. And we have a limited capacity. Our liver has a limited capacity to metabolize the stuff. And when that capacity is overwhelmed by our current diet, our liver has no choice but to turn that extra sugar into liver fat. And when you make liver fat, that starts the cascade of metabolic diseases that we just talked about. In fact, we have shown that sugar is the proximate cause of diabetes worldwide.
Are you looking for governments here in the United States and elsewhere to start treating sugar like a drug, like a toxic substance at certain levels in our food?
Look, in order for a substance to fall under governmental control, it has to satisfy four criteria. These are criteria developed by the public health community, and they certainly apply to both tobacco and alcohol. These are the four criteria. Ubiquity, that is, you can't get away from it. Toxicity, that is, it has to cause disease in doses that are commonly used. Abuse, that is, you can't stop using it. And finally, negative impact on society, meaning how does your consumption affect me? Now, for tobacco and alcohol, all four of those criteria are easily achieved, no problem. And everybody understands that. And so we regulate alcohol and tobacco. We even have an agency in Washington to do so. It's called the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. For sugar, does it meet these four criteria? And the answer is, it does. In fact, we've published a comment in Nature magazine back in February of 2012 demonstrating how sugar meets these four criteria very specifically. And so, based on that construct, we ought to be considering doing something to reduce our sugar consumption to something more manageable. The question is, how does one do that without government? I would love to see the food industry do this voluntarily. They will not. In fact, they have said they will not. We have approached them directly, and they have basically told us this is for each individual to deal with, not for government or for us to dictate. You know, it's basically the personal responsibility issue.
Now, you
it's
talk
the
about
consumer
the
freedom issue.
You talk about the 56 different kinds of sugar, and you list them in this ebook. And I know a large part of this ebook is dedicated to helping the consumer sort of navigate where these hidden sugars lie and how to avoid them. But, you know, we hear so many different things about sugar. I mean, I've done different interviews where people say they're all the same. Sugar is every version of it is the same, from high fructose corn syrup to table sugar to agave nectar to honey. Do you subscribe to that? Are sweeteners different, or is it one worse than the other?
No, if they're caloric, basically that means they're one molecule of glucose and one molecule of fructose, whether they're strung together or not, basically. All of the data on each sweetener itself, each caloric sweetener, says that they are equivalent metabolically and equivalent in terms of the abuse potential. So I don't differentiate between them. I think they're all equally problematic. It's not one thing. It's all of them put together. In fact, everyone says high fructose corn syrup is the devil. But, you know, the fact is high fructose corn syrup is only available in America, Canada, Japan, and very limited exposure in parts of Europe. We just found out a week ago that the diabetes prevalence in China is now 11.6%, and it is because of their increased consumption of sugar as well. So it does not have to be HFCS. It can be any form. The fact is that sugar has just gotten immeasurably cheap, and because it's gotten cheap, it has appeared in everything. It's in every food, and it's in foods you didn't know had it. Like, the big one is yogurt. You think yogurt's healthy? Try again. And there you are in Wisconsin, in America's Dairyland. If you think yogurt is healthy, I got a bridge to sell you.
What if you get the plain stuff?
Sorry?
What if you get plain yogurt?
Well, plain yogurt is just fine. Plain yogurt is what the Europeans eat. You know, the old Danon commercial with the 120-year-old people bouncing off the, bouncing off the walls. You know, plain yogurt is just fine. Well, how many grams of sugar are in a plain yogurt? The answer is 7, and they're all lactose, which is milk sugar, which is perfectly fine and not even remotely a problem. But let's take a pomegranate yogurt. That has 19 grams of sugar, and that's all added sugar, very specifically by the food industry. Look, yogurt is sour milk. The only difference between the milk that sours in your refrigerator and yogurt is that you get to choose the bacteria that does the souring. That's the difference. Yogurt is supposed to be sour, but in America, yogurt is sweet. And that's on purpose, because otherwise they couldn't sell it. The Europeans take plain yogurt and add real fruit to it in order to cut the sourness. We don't. We've turned yogurt into dessert. We've turned yogurt into a health food, and it couldn't be anything further from that.
We're talking to Dr. Robert Lustig about his new book, Sugar Has 56 Names. He's ringing the alarm bell about the amount of sugar we consume in this country.
And what about you? Are you worried about sugar in our food? Do you try to avoid it at the grocery store? Are you aware when you're eating it in different foods, like the example of a flavored yogurt that we just heard about? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking right now with Dr. Robert Lustig. He's the author of the e-book Sugar Has 56 Names. And we want to hear from you on this.
How do you navigate the grocery store? Do you read the labels? Do you compare how much sugar is in one thing versus another? Do you even know what it means? I don't. Is 3 grams a lot? Is 17 grams a lot? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org. Robert, is that a common theme? People look at a label, and is that a big number? Is that a small number? What is a lot of sugar in a single serving item?
That's exactly the problem. Nobody knows. And there's a reason why nobody knows. It's because they don't want you to know. Let me explain. If you look at the Nutrition Facts label, next to every single item on the table, there is a number with a percentage sign. And it's called the percent DV, percent daily value, also known as the dietary reference intake. So that tells you whether or not a certain food has enough of any given vitamin or any, you know, or cholesterol or total fat or protein or anything else, so that you should be able to, if you pay attention, figure out what's appropriate for your diet. There is only one item that does not have a percent DV. There's one item that does not have a dietary reference intake, and it's sugar.
Hmm.
And that's on purpose. I asked Sam Cass, who is Michelle Obama's personal chef and her point person to her obesity task force, at a meeting 2 years ago in front of 150 people. I asked him why there was no dietary reference intake for sugar. And his response was, and this is a direct quote, "Why would you need a DRI for something that was not a nutrient?" Think about that. Think about what that means.
I don't know.
That's exactly why we need a DRI. The fact is, sugar has no inherent nutritional value. He is right. It is not a nutrient. It is a source of energy. I don't argue that. But it is not a nutrient. It is not something you need. It's just like alcohol. Do you need alcohol? No. Do people who consume alcohol get in trouble? Well, it depends on the dose. So the question is, how much is an appropriate dose? Well, we know what an appropriate dose of alcohol is, and sugar, because of the way it's metabolized, is metabolized virtually the same as alcohol. After all, where do you get alcohol from? Fermentation of sugar. Mm-hmm. It's called wine. We do it in Napa and Sonoma every day. So for alcohol, we know how much is too much. For sugar, we are specifically kept from knowing how much is too much because the food industry doesn't want us to know. You don't think that's a war? You're damn right that's a war.
Well, we have a lot of folks waiting to talk to you, so let's get to the phones. We've got Natasha with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Natasha.
Hello. I'm really excited about the topic because I really watch, you know, the sugar consumptions, and I agree with everything that I hear, but also wanted to comment that I don't know if it will be, let's say we have the strictest rules in the country saying this is so you can eat of sugar and this is how much, you know, you don't go above that line. I don't know if that's going to resolve the problem because people may find a way to get the sugar as, you know, we know with alcohol they do. But educating people and starting with school programs, educating, you know, today's generation about the impact sugars, different kinds can do, that's critical. Knowing this sugar is better for you to consume, you know, versus this sugar, that's key. And reading labels, reading information, because there's so much information out there. But working with that information, educating children, that's key. But I don't know if establishing very strict rules out there, if that's going to really bring us, you know, to the results we really hoping to see.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Natasha. Robert, could you walk us through, you know, if we don't have a recommended daily allowance, we have to keep tabs on it ourselves. How much sugar should we be eating ideally a day, if any, I guess?
Well, the fact is that the toxic threshold that the American Heart Association set is 6 to 9 teaspoons of added sugar per day, 6 for women, 9 for men. Our current consumption is 22 teaspoons of added sugar per day. So that means a reduction by 2/3 to 3/4. So let's talk about where the sugar in our diet is. 1/3 of it is in soft drinks, fruit juices, you know, sugar-sweetened beverages, if you will. 1/6 of it is in candy, desserts, ice cream, things that you would normally identify as dessert. That means fully 1/2 of the sugar in our diet is in things we didn't know had sugar, like tomato sauce, barbecue sauce, hamburger buns, hamburger meat, you name it, virtually everything in the store, bread, commercially available bread. So if 1/2 of the sugar is in stuff we didn't know had it, even if you got rid of all the sugar-sweetened beverages, even if you got rid of all the candy and desserts, you'd still be over your limit. That's why it's a problem. And you can't just look at the ingredients label because there are 56 names for sugar. The food industry uses all 56 because they have to declare on the label what the sugar content is by mass. So you can make a different form of sugar, number 5, number 6, number 7, number 8. When you add them up, it's number 1. So they have many ways to hide what they're doing, and they want to keep it that way.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Sarah with us in Zion, Illinois. Hi there, Sarah.
Hi. I am really, really excited because, Doctor, I heard you on the People's Pharmacy 2 years ago. And for about 19 years now, I've been struggling with this thing called candidiasis, which is like an imbalance of your intestinal flora. And to get over it, you've got to get rid of all sugar. And I was just a horrible sugar addict, and it just took me years and years and years to even reduce it. And when I heard you on the show, you talked about this whole liver metabolism thing and the whole you need the fiber, and it's like a little light bulb went on in my head, because I'd been giving into my cravings with like agave syrup and maple syrup, and I just wasn't getting better. But when I heard you, it felt like, you know, this is what my body needs, and I was able to resist those cravings and only have whole fruit. And I can't tell you how my life is just so much better.
Well, great. Thank you for sharing that, Sarah. And I wanted to get Dr. Lustig to respond. Obviously, you're probably excited to hear from her.
Well, here's the problem, Rob and Veronica. Here's the problem. Every one of the people who call in and say what their experience is, you know, that's great and it's wonderful and it's heartening and I love it, but they're all ends of one. None of them do any proof. There's no proof to, you know, the fact that if you get rid of sugar, it will make a difference. However, the data, the real data, the science, the actual causation shows it. And that's what I'm pushing. Okay, this is about science. I am about science. I do not talk about anecdotes. I do not talk about what might happen or what could happen or what, you know, is a postulate. I talk about real hard science, and the science says this is a problem and this is what's going on, and the economics says we can't afford what's going on in healthcare today. This, we cannot fix healthcare until we fix metabolic syndrome.
And I want to ask you, Dr. Lustig, based on what you've seen, based on the data you've seen, is it possible to reverse metabolic syndrome for people who do make a good faith effort to cut sugar out?
Absolutely. You can make a huge difference by cutting sugar out. Now, there will be some people where there'll have to be even more that will have to be done. And sometimes you'll need pharmacotherapy and sometimes you'll even need surgery. I don't say that sugar reduction or cessation will work for everybody, but I can say that no matter who you are, sugar reduction will help you. I can't say it will fix everything, but I guarantee you it won't hurt you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We wish you well. Thank you for coming on and sharing your thoughts with us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Dr. Robert Lustig. He has a new ebook out. It's called Sugar Has 56 Names.
Coming up, a look at new data out today about unemployment. Our guest says part of America is facing depression-era levels of joblessness. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Don't forget, you can keep the conversations going that we've started here on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us about your experiences with sugar. Maybe you've cut it out, and we'd like to hear what you have to say about it. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about the changing ways people use the internet and why nearly one in five Americans don't go online.
First, though, the unemployment gap in the United States is the widest on record.
Usually when we talk about unemployment, it's that one number. We take the whole population. But when our next guest broke it down by income bracket, he saw some big differences.
Those in the higher income brackets are at almost full employment, while those at the lower end are experiencing unemployment at rates equal to the Great Depression.
Ishwar Kadiwada co-authored this study. An update of it was released today. He's here with us now. Ishwar is an economist at the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University. Ishwar, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So how bad is unemployment for people at the lower end of the income scale?
It is seriously bad. The unemployment rate for low-income American families exceeds 21%, which is equivalent to the unemployment rate of all workers during the Great Recession of the 30s. So at the other end, unemployment rate for workers from affluent families hovers around 3%. This means one part of America is in full employment and another part of America is in serious depression.
So
Even the middle-income workers are not faring well. Their employment is down, their unemployment rate is all-time high, and their wages are down.
And that's part of the story as I read your work. Some of the middle-class workers, a lot of them are unemployed, but also a lot of them are getting the jobs that the people at the lower end would have gotten, so they're being kind of bumped out of work.
Absolutely. The economy began to recover in the second quarter of 2009, and we have created more than 6 million jobs so far. But we have created more like jobs in the lower end than in upper end. So there is a crowding out effect in the labor market. There is no growth in middle-skilled jobs, and there is no substantial overall job creation. As a result, jobs that traditionally employ young and college-educated workers are being taken by other groups, for example, college-educated workers. And that's why low-income and young people are pushed left behind this recovery.
So we talk about this as an economic recovery, and by some standards it is, but I guess when you're looking at from this perspective, is it fair to call it a recovery when you're looking at it for low-income workers?
It's not a recovery for low-income workers, definitely not.
What's gone? What is missing? What kind of jobs went away?
We have a lot of these traditional jobs, manufacturing jobs. They are historically low. They have not recovered. Jobs in utilities, transportation, that typically employs these workers are gone. That's why there's a massive surplus of these workers in the labor market.
And there's been a lot of attention to things like job training, saying people, the workers you're talking about, the ones without a college education, don't have skills in today's workplace. Even if they got that skills training, even if they got matched up to the jobs, are there enough jobs out there to accommodate them?
No, there are not enough jobs to accommodate them in recent years, because besides this unemployment problem, there's a massive increase in underemployment and hidden unemployment problems. There are more than 8 million workers who want full-time jobs but are working part-time for economic reasons because no full-time jobs are available to them. There's another group we call underemployed workers. There are more than 6 million of these workers who want jobs if offered but are not active in the labor force. They have given up job search because they think that no jobs are available to them. We call this group hidden unemployed. So if we combine these three groups, unemployed, underemployed, and hidden employed, we come up with a number just under 27 million people with these three problems. That accounts for 16% of the labor force. And we call this labor force underutilization problem. And it's more than two times higher than the official unemployment rate.
That official unemployment rate, that's the one that makes headlines each month. We look at that rate, the numbers released by the federal government. You're saying when we consider those unemployed people, the people who stop looking for jobs and the people who are underemployed, it's more than double, really, what the usual rate is.
Absolutely.
Is that number a misleading number, that when it comes out in the 7 to 8% range?
I don't call it misleading, but, you know, if we include those underemployed and hidden employed, yeah, this number, the official unemployment numbers could be misleading. But, Rob, labor force underutilization rates varied by family income level, okay? Low-income workers have the labor underutilization rate of nearly 40%.
40%?
Absolutely. Compared to 7% for workers from the affluent families. And the labor force underutilization problems for low-income African-American is the worst. Nearly half of the workers from low-income African-American families are underutilized compared to underutilization rate of 37 to 38% for the same group of workers in white and Hispanic families. So these rates are more than two times higher than the rates that prevailed prior to the Great Recession. So the labor market underutilization problems for workers in affluent families in all of these middle groups typically ran to 7 to 11%.
How did these numbers look before the Great Recession? Were they close to where we are now as far as the inequality that you're talking about?
They were pretty low. Since the Great Recession, these numbers have like doubled.
And do you see this turning around anytime soon?
Actually, these labor market problems for especially America's low-income workers, they won't go away unless we create enough jobs to absorb this massive existing labor surplus. With the current job creation, these problems will linger for a long time, and it will create a long, you know, very unequal society.
I know you're an analysis guy, not necessarily a policy guy, but do you think that there are policies that the government should be undertaking to try to close this gap?
Absolutely. For example, we can create a tax incentive program for employers to hire low-income workers, evidence so that it has worked in the past. And also, we need to invest more in job training programs. We need to reinstate summer and year-round employment programs for low-income youth, evidence so that, you know, employment is path-dependent. The more youth work today, the more likely they'll be working tomorrow and earn more.
And you've done a lot of work in the past on teen and younger workers. What's the situation looking like for them after the Great Recession?
Their labor market condition is the worst since the Great Depression. We have, for youth, like teen workers, you have an underutilization rate of nearly 50 to 60%. So teens want jobs, but they're not getting jobs. Their EP ratio is the lowest historically. In this summer, only 27% of teens worked. In 1989-90, nearly 55 to 60% of teens used to work. So their employment situation had deteriorated so much.
Ishwar, thanks a lot for joining us and sharing these numbers with us.
Thank you.
That was Ishwar Kadiwada. He's an economist at the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University, co-author of the study we've been talking about published by the AP.
And next, we'll look at why 1 in 5 Americans don't use the Internet. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Internet is a moving target, and the way we use it changes as new gadgets come out, from desktop computers to laptops and phones and now watches and goggles.
Our next guest studies how and why people use the Internet or don't use it, and there's a new study out today. Catherine Zeker is a research associate at the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get to the newest research you have today, I was curious about some work you did earlier this year on people who don't access the Internet, about 15%, a little more, of Americans. What reasons do people give for not going online?
Well, that's such an interesting question, because we can really only probe the main reasons, the broad outlines of why people don't use the Internet in general. And we generally find that the top reason is just that people aren't really interested, and they're not really sure how it would be relevant to their lives.
And that's interesting. I mean, we hear about the digital divide a lot, and that's part of the answer to people lacking access or can't afford it. But there's a big chunk of people out there who don't want to use the online, want to use the internet. They don't see it as relevant.
No, that's true. And over the past few years, anywhere from about 1 in 5 to 15% of Americans just haven't been online at all. There's also another slice of the population that uses the internet in some form but lacks home access. And we actually recently found that about 1 in 10 Americans owns a smartphone but doesn't have high-speed home broadband at home. So there's a good chunk of people who are connecting to the internet just from their phones.
And how does that break down by age, the people who aren't online?
For people who aren't online at all, they tend to be older, lower income, or with lower levels of education. But when you look at people who go online, say, mostly with their cell phones, who lack home or who go online only with their smartphones, who don't have home access, they actually tend to be a bit younger. But also with lower levels of income and education.
So it's interesting. You've got an older demographic who's not going online at all, a younger group who is starting to go online but without benefit of the old-fashioned desktop computers or laptops.
Yeah, and we actually did – we had another study just out today mm-hmm. about people who go online mostly with their cell phones. So people who probably have access, you know, for a desktop or laptop at home, but – just say that they do most of their internet browsing on their cell phone. And we found that among younger adults who go online with their cell phones, about half say they go online mostly with their phones.
And this is trending, as they say, on the web search engines. This is something that is on the rise, right?
Yes. No, the proportion of cell phone owners who do most of their browsing with their phones has about doubled since 2009. So this is definitely a trend that we're seeing increasing.
Well, this has got to be maybe a frustrating part of doing the research you do, or maybe the fun part. It's such a moving target as the technology changes. What, does it make your head spin trying to keep up with all this, or does it make sure you know, still have a job?
It is always fascinating seeing what's happening now and trying to study new things. It is a moving target, but it's always very exciting. So we're trying to study, you know, people who don't use the internet, people who maybe don't even have a cell phone. Most people have cell phones, but about 1 in 10 don't. But we're also trying to keep track of some of these newer things popping up, like Twitter or Snapchat.
And are you seeing a growth? We mentioned in our introduction some of the brand new stuff, the watches and the Google Glass goggle things. Those aren't out there really for general use yet. Do you anticipate that, you know, maybe in a year or two we're going to be having the same conversation about phones on the rise, but with these other gadgets instead?
Well, you've raised that's such a fascinating point, because the internet is now on so many devices that increasingly in 10 years it will be interesting to see what devices we ask about, or if it even makes sense to talk about when you're online and when you're off. But for now, we're sticking to talking about regular internet use, smartphones, things like that.
And I'm kind of old-fashioned. I do most of my work on desktop computers. I'll use the phone out there in a pinch. Am I a bit of a dinosaur already by still using this, what, 20-year-old technology?
Well, if it helps, you are probably in line with the habits of your age group. If you were 18, you might be a bit of an outlier. But and in general, most people tend to do most of their online activities on a desktop or a laptop. Young folks are just a bit more mobile.
Now, going back to the people who aren't online at all, I think of filling out school forms, doing medical references, and especially job applications nowadays. Are people seeing this as a challenge? If I'm offline, it's really starting to be an obstacle in my life?
I think that's something that you see. I know that a lot of librarians, for instance, have told us that they see offline adults really running into obstacles when they need to use the internet because, like you said, some form that they need to fill out is available only online. This is something that you especially see with people who have, or we hear from more with people who go online just with their smartphones. Is that if you think about the interface of some of these forms, what you're trying to do, the level of complexity, it can be really difficult for a smaller screen or, again, when you need to go to a library or some other place and you have a time limit, or if you just aren't comfortable using the technology in general. So that is definitely something we're going to keep an eye on as more more things, more services move online only.
And I know you've studied the role of libraries. I wanted to expand on that a little. How much are people relying on libraries to meet those needs that you were just talking about?
Libraries are definitely a role in how people connect to the internet and access online resources when they don't have home access. We know that about a quarter of Americans use the internet or wireless at libraries, so I think a quarter of library users do that. And that's pretty steady across age groups. Younger people are actually pretty big users of the internet at libraries. And we hear from librarians a lot when they help people use the internet. For adults who aren't familiar with using the internet, sometimes it's not necessarily even just an issue of access, but it's trying to learn how to do simple things like signing up for an email account, keeping track of passwords, understanding which service wants which login information. So even though most adults use the internet now, for those that don't, it can be confusing to try to use it for the first time.
Kara on Facebook writes, I would get so much done if I didn't use the internet. Well, thanks for taking the time to do that, Kara, to post that. But do we know about productivity? Are people saying that the internet increases or decreases how much they get done at work or in their lives?
That is something that we hear in different places. And I think it's really interesting to look at how people use their cell phones for internet access, because cell phones are pretty intimate. You know, they're with you, they're in your pocket. A good portion of people sleep with their cell phones right next to them on the bed. So what we hear from mobile users is that they both really appreciate the convenience of these devices and always having the internet with them or always being able to reach people they want to. But it is a distraction, and it can sometimes feel a little overwhelming for people to be constantly on call or to constantly have, distractions at their fingertips.
Do you have, and I may be going beyond the research you do there, but do you have a sense that people are trying to evolve, A, an etiquette for how they use these things, and B, to manage the time they have so they're not overwhelmed, they're not feeling constantly connected, and they disconnect from time to time on purpose?
I love hearing about the latest etiquette rules regarding these devices. It seems, unscientifically, it seems like each group of friends, for instance, has its own rules about whether it's all right to look at your phone during dinner. Is maybe texting okay, but not calling? Cell phones are actually, relative to a lot of technologies we use, they're pretty new. So a lot of these norms and these etiquettes are still evolving.
And do you have a sense of a difference in how the so-called the digital natives, the people who grew up with the internet, view this versus us old stodgy folks age 40 and up?
Young people, especially teens, might have some different expectations around some of these devices. What we know for sure is that they're generally using these technologies more. Teens especially are big texters and have always been pretty active users of social networking sites. So sometimes just because they're so active on these technologies, they can look a little strange to maybe generations that haven't been using them as much.
Do you see that being an avenue for conflict between the younger generation, the digital natives, and the older people?
Again, anecdotally, I think many parents would say that it has been a source of conflict. But in general, like I said, we're seeing norms evolve. We're seeing expectations evolve. We're at a point where, again, the vast majority of Americans now have smartphones, and actually vast majority of Americans have cell phones, and a majority have smartphones. So this is something that we're seeing really come into the mainstream in a big way.
And one thing I didn't want to forget to ask you, we've talked about how people are accessing the internet. Do you have a sense in your ongoing research there at the Pew Center on what people are doing with the internet for the most part? Fun, work, half and half?
Everything would be the short answer. For instance, one of the most popular activities that we've studied over time has been searching for health information. People turn to the internet with questions they have, especially maybe things they might not want to ask another person necessarily. But they are also using it, as they always have, for communication, to email, increasingly to share things on social networking sites, and just connect with others. So these are things that we've seen continue over time, just in different forms and on different platforms.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Catherine Zeker, Research Associate at the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project. And I want to hear from you if you are one of the people we were talking about earlier. You're not online. You don't go on the Internet. I'm not going to send you to our Facebook page or email. You can call the Central Time hotline and share your story. Maybe we can talk to you on a future show. 855-683-5422 is the number to call. 855-683-5422. Veronica, I feel like sometimes, you know, we assume everybody out there is on the Internet, but yet 15% of our listeners probably at least aren't.
Turns out not everybody's on there. So We'll have to see. Yeah, give us a call at the hotline and tell us your story. We'd be happy to hear from you. And coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll hear about a new Frontline documentary that's tracking the upheavals in Egypt.
We'll talk to a scientist who's trying to come up with a cure for the common cold. A lot of people are going down with that lately, and that got us thinking, isn't there something they can do about it, those scientists?
I don't know. I have a bad feeling about that one.
Me too.
And we'll explore the way Wisconsin talks and the regional and ethnic accents in our state.
Tune in tomorrow. That's all coming up here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.